Hey everybody, welcome back to the Love That Lasts podcast. This week, Melanie and Seth are back with the Anatomy of Marriage miniseries, and this is episode 4, and it's titled, What Do We Do Now? And it's talking all about the many ways that our life experiences deeply impact us as individuals, but also how they shape our marriages. I know you guys are going to absolutely love it. And quick disclaimer here, the second half of the episode gets into some pretty heavy topics like sexual abuse and domestic violence. And so we just wanted to let you know up front that we'll be discussing these things in this episode in case you wanted to fast forward or if they're triggers for you. Melanie will give you a heads up before the heavy stuff starts, so you can skip ahead if you need to when she says.
We're going to start off this week's episode with a couple that I know pretty well.
My whole name, Sean.
What's your name?
Carrie.
So Carrie is my sister. She's only 3 years older than I am and lives 5 minutes down the road with her husband, Sean, and their 4 kids. They've been married for 15 years.
So when was the very first time you saw Sean?
Was it my birthday?
No.
It's Winnie's birthday, I think. Wasn't it when we made spaghetti at Winnie's house? Do you not remember that?
I remember it. I probably just ignored you, I imagine.
You did.
My sister's a little weird.
So what was your actual first date?
We've never gone on a date.
Never. What do you mean you've never been on a date?
We really don't go on dates. We never did, really.
Well, there's been times like, we've gone to dinner with like just Carrie and I.
It's always super awkward. I don't know. It's like wherever we are, we just are ourselves.
Yeah, so may as well be.
Why don't we go somewhere to spend money? I can just sit right here and be next to you. It's fine.
Do you guys ever fight?
We don't fight. We get upset with each other sometimes. But then we're both kind of when we're mad, just don't really want to talk about it.
Yeah. Right.
It's really healthy.
I think it's the healthiest.
Yeah, the healthiest thing to do. I think we would have more like fights maybe before we had kids or like when they were little.
Yeah.
Just because it's like you're still trying to figure out marriage and like your expectations versus reality and why isn't this person measuring up or what's wrong? What am I doing? Yeah, like that kind of stuff.
But yeah.
I think the older we've gotten, it's just like, who cares?
Yeah.
Like, honestly. Especially, I think, over the last couple years, and maybe it has to do with Grant's going through the stuff with Grant, it kind of throws stuff into a tailspin. So you're trying to figure that out that you don't care about things. But.
Did you say Grant?
Say Grant.
This is my nephew. He just turned 5.
What else can you say? Can you say train?
Is this your train?
Are you looking at that?
Before Grant was born, Sean and Carrie lived 100 miles away on the east side of the Cascade Mountains in Ellensburg, where they had met in college. After getting married, they decided to stay there and raise their family. And that's what they did until about 2.5 years ago.
Tickle bug.
happy.
When Grant was just a baby, Carrie noticed that he was doing things that his older brother and sisters had never done when they were little. So she was curious about it.
Let's see, I think I just happened to be on the computer, like looking at child development things because he wasn't talking very much.
At what age? Like
18 months or something. Mm-hmm. Usually when babies start talking or whatever. And he would say a couple things, like he said bye once or twice on his own, but then we were trying to get him to say juice and he just wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And usually kids, like they'll try.
Yeah.
He just wouldn't even try. He'd just be like, nope, don't care. And then he started, I think what really made me start looking, less so than the speaking or anything like that, was when he started spinning all the time. When he was that little, he would spin and like look out of the corner of his eyes when he spun. It's very non-typical looking because it's just like, what is that kid doing?
Yeah.
Because they're not trying to engage with any other kids or anything. He's just purely because he wants to do it. So as soon as I remember like super vividly, I typed it into the search bar and everything that came up was like, when kids spin and look out of the corner of their eyes, is it always autism? Like, that was like every single, I'm like,
wow.
Oh, crap.
Yeah.
I thought, well, he can't have autism because I don't know why I thought that. I knew nothing about it. But
you thought he couldn't have it?
Yeah. So then as soon as I started clicking on things and it was just describing him, everything was really. I was like, oh, that, yep, He does that. He does that. He does that. So I knew, like, the next day. I think I probably knew that night that he had autism, like, for sure. Mm-hmm. Because it was just too, way too much that was exactly like him. That when he's so little, you just don't think about it. Because it just is like, well, he's little. So it'll happen. It's not anything scary yet. It's fine. But because he matched everything so well, it was like, no, that's what it is.
After Grant's diagnosis, Sean and Carrie began looking for therapy options in Ellensburg and the surrounding cities, but they kept striking out. They knew they needed as much therapy as they could get for him, per the recommendations of doctors and parents within the autism community, but Ellensburg just didn't have it. So the idea of moving to the west side of the mountains was looking like the best choice for Grant and his needs. But that was a big jump for their family.
I had a conversation with my boss before I left Kittitas, and she had known for a while that I was looking for work and we were going to have to move and all this stuff. And she'd said stuff about how it must be hard and this and that and how it's just such a big thing. And I looked at her and I said, you know, it kind of is. But at the end of the day, he's just our son. And we're just taking care of our son the way that we would take care of any of our other kids if they had any kind of need. And when I look at it like that, it's like, well, this is just what parents do. And this is what I want to do and want to be able to do, because it's like, if I can do something to help my kids out and make their lives better, then that's the whole point of being a dad or a mom or whatever. So it's kind of a rewarding thing because I feel like I'm fulfilling my job as a parent. The decision to move was not hard by any means, because it was like, well, that's what we need to do, because we need to get granted therapy as soon as possible and we can't make it happen in Ellensburg.
I asked my sister if she thought that Grant's diagnosis had changed her.
Our life went a certain way, and it was really, really good, comparatively speaking, to majority of people. So I just figured the rest of my life would go that way. So I think when that happened with Grant, it helped me see that I have much less control than I think I have. Mm-hmm. So trying to control things that I cannot control is an exercise and futility. So there are certain things that don't bother me nearly as much. And that honestly, I see other parents have a lot of anxiety or stress about. And to me, it's hard to be in my position because they haven't had a child with autism, so they don't have anything to compare it to.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, oh, you know, they're stressing out that their kid is doing whatever it is. And to me, it's like, yeah, I wish Grant would do that. In some ways, I think the diagnosis help me see that trying to control everything, like who they're turning into and how they're doing in school and all that stuff, it doesn't quite work that way. Doesn't quite work out that way, I don't think, but I could be totally wrong.
When I asked them if they thought that, here's me, Seth, and Matt again, having a child with autism affected their marriage, both of them were like, no, I don't think it does.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, how could it not?
Right. Well, I think that they took that question, how does having a son with autism affect your marriage negatively, right? But I can see positive ways, like this shared experience that they have of both having, you know, the same son with the same diagnosis makes them have to perform at every level in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And shared experiences are what brings couples, relationships,
soldiers
together.
Or anybody, though.
Anything.
Yeah.
You know,
that's really interesting because a lot of, actually, Dr. Corey Allen, who you'll hear in another episode, talks about that is like the next phase of relationships, because you have the beginning of relationships that's like that oxytocin, you know, like passionate stuff. And then it's the shared experience that creates the sort of the longevity within a marriage. So I never thought of it.
Right. Well, just think about it, like breaking it down really simply, time together, spending time together on positive and negative things, shared experiences, you know, relating to one another through the same lens of what's going on.
So even if the relating is through supporting their child who has autism.
Exactly.
That can be a positive thing. When I sat down to review the tape for this episode, I realized how incredibly judgmental I was being. And this isn't very fun to admit, but I was completely under the impression that when I asked Sean and Carrie how having a child with autism had affected them, that they would both say, oh, it's been so hard, it's changed everything, but they both had very grounded attitudes about it. I just think it's worth noting that my preconceived idea of what it would do to your relationship when you have an autistic child was completely incorrect, and it painted the way that I saw Sean and Carrie's relationship incorrectly. I think there's something very interesting there.
Working together to overcome obstacles or to achieve a goal against adversity is the recipe for all deep relationships, whether it be soldiers or friends trying to accomplish something together, or in marriage, having kids is going to be that. And then having a specific type of adversity with a child makes them even more narrowly bonded together, in that they feel like they're the only two people that know this specific thing, and it's a challenge for both of them. Right. But in every way also, it is difficult. I mean, in many, many ways too, it's difficult and a cause of stress. So just having a kid binds a man and woman together, and also introduces a massive amounts of new stresses that is going to cause conflict between them.
I think probably the biggest challenge for our own culture.
Here's Claudia Grofgrounds again, who we heard in episode 2 and 3.
Is that we think that coupling and marriage is having just that warm, safe home to be in. Mm-hmm. But I actually think it's also the place of, therapists call it secondary trauma, where I actually, when I get close to you and I know that your history and your pain, I suffer with you. There's suffering that happens in marriages, and there's hopefully compassion and care that comes out of that shared mm-hmm. suffering, but I'm going to be affected by that. You're going to be impatient with me in a relationship because of your history sometimes. Mm-hmm. You're going to hurt me. How do I love you in that? I think there's a lot of myths from movies and our culture that somehow marriage is supposed to be happily ever after. In my belief, and it really comes from a spiritual belief, mm-hmm. that we love each other in shared suffering sometimes.
Yeah.
That's where there's a place for grace, loving you in spite of you, mm-hmm. Is going to be a big part of it. So I think that's that balance of spirituality that comes through in my understanding that I'm going to be affected by your history and your pain and your life, and that's going to be part of my life, mm-hmm. and I'm going to share in that suffering. We don't talk about shared suffering in marriage very often.
No, that's not the fun part.
That's not the fun part, and yet that's so much the... When I'm sitting in therapy and people are sharing that part of their lives, the mm-hmm. most pained part of their lives, that's huge. Mm-hmm. That's really the hardest fights, the most painful fights, are often in those places. Mm-hmm. And the healing can be the deepest, and you can have the most intimacy in those too.
Melanie and Seth are learning that even the difficult experiences in our lives and marriages can be worked on together to help us grow closer as a couple, and that is so amazing and really a beautiful picture of the way that the mercy and restoration of God works in our lives. So we'll get back to their journey in a minute, but first a word from our sponsors.
This episode of the Love That Lasts podcast is brought to you by Datebox, the monthly subscription that helps grow your relationship. Every month, you get a box that's packed with everything needed for a fun, creative, and unique date night, and it's delivered right to your door. You don't even have to think about it. You don't have to make reservations. Visit getdatebox.com and use the promo code LOVETHATLASTS at the checkout to get your free box. You can just check it out, see if you like it. Datebox, your relationship matters.
Now back to the story.
So all of us have unfinished business in our life, mm-hmm. and it clamors for our attention at an unconscious level.
This is Les and Leslie Parrott, who you'll remember from previous episodes.
And I often liken it to holding a fully inflated basketball underneath the water in a swimming pool, and you're trying your best to act like it's not there, but all your energy is focused on keeping that thing submerged. Mm-hmm. That's what it's like when we have unfinished business in our life. We're constantly being clamored by this. And it can be about, you know, some kind of healing, some woundedness mm-hmm. that we're carrying around. It can be some kind of compulsions that we have, but it's bound to impact a marriage.
Well, it's quite consuming and it's compelling too. And it's always in the background. And it's also quite often why we choose the people we do to love, because there's a way they can help us finish that business mm-hmm. or we're seeking that closure with them. Mm-hmm. So it is very powerful. And so we're deeply affected by our past mm-hmm. and so is our spouse.
Right.
We're going to go back to my sister Carrie and her husband Sean for a minute and talk about a time in Sean's life that shaped him tremendously as a young man. It all starts when Sean's father is diagnosed with cancer.
He had a tumor. They said a tumor the size of a pear wrapped up in his lower back and in his spine and stuff.
Yeah.
There was long periods of time when he would lay on the couch and we'd all be outside because if we were inside playing, it'd be too loud or our steps would be thump, thump, thump and would shake, you know, and that would hurt, cause more pain. And so there was a long period of time when it's just like, I wasn't sure exactly what was going on, but I knew my dad wasn't okay. And then he had the tumor removed. I thought, oh, awesome. And they're like, oh, well, he still has to go through radiation therapy because, you know, he can get the big mass out, but he can't get all the little stuff. And so went through that, and that was bad because radiation, you know, it's just, it makes you weak. It makes you lose your hair, that kind of stuff. Then, because he was going for a while, he was coming back and forth between the Tri-Cities and Virginia Mason in Seattle for the treatments. And then they saw that the tumors had spread up into his brain. They put this little small piece of gold, they implanted in his head. And it like attracts the radiation so it doesn't kill the good stuff. It only kills the cancer. And so I'm like, oh, okay, well, you know, and they're going back and forth. There's like a monthly thing. They'd go back, go over here for the weekend and come back. And that was a normal thing for a long time. And then I woke up in the morning and there was my mom and my dad's best friend from childhood who had driven them over there, sitting in the kitchen. They were there and I said, I was all excited and happy, right? Because there's mom, yay. And I said, well, where's dad? And she said, dad's not coming home. Dad died.
So I know your mother married your dad's brother. Mm-hmm. How old were you when that happened?
I was a senior in high school, so I was 18, just turned 18.
So there was a 5-year difference between...
Yeah.
Was that a hard time for you, like when...
It originally was, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it was just weird on several levels for me, because like, okay, well, it's my uncle and you're my mom. And of course, one of my biggest things... How do I say, tell my friends that my mom married my uncle? And then there was a little part of me, I remember actually thinking that was like a betrayal of my dad, betrayal of my dad.
Right.
Because it's like, that's his brother and all that weird stuff that's just not real. It's just what a 15, 16-year-old kid thinks in his head when he doesn't understand things. The change it made in my mom's life was ridiculous, right? So my dad dies and it's just my mom, my brother, my sister, and me. And it's like we were, you know, okay, whatever. But definitely my mom was depressed. And then I noticed the more my uncle, Doug, coming around, I noticed she being happier. And I thought that was great. But at the same time, it's like, well, why couldn't she have found some guy that was not related to me?
When I asked him if he thought, here's me, Seth, and Matt again. His father passing was related to how he handles his son having autism and all of that stuff. He says, no, he doesn't think it matters. But like... I see it like he had to deal with his father dying and then deal with emotionally understanding his mother marrying his uncle, which would have to at some point make you go like have emotional intelligence for other people and be like, I can see how this is benefiting my mom, even though it's confusing to me. I don't like how it feels, but I'm going to sort of be okay with it and happy with it because of how it affects someone else.
Accept it because it's for the greater good, right? Now the family can continue. It just makes sense. So
wait, so you're saying you think it's an asset for him to have gone through that trauma and having to do the work of understanding how something works out for another person and having that broadness of experience makes him more understanding of how to navigate or deal with something like having a child with a disability?
Yeah, I think I think that it has sort of set the stage for him to be more accepting of circumstances and situations and see that what might feel really terrible right now might not feel so terrible.
Or might not be about you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We could talk about how like each major life event pretty much sets you up for dealing with the next major life event, either negatively or positively. In this case, you know, Sean turned, you know, the passing of his father, the weirdness of his mom marrying his uncle, And, you know, he had a he had made meaning of that, you know, as a young teenager. And then as he matured into like, oh, I'm a dad now, made a different meaning of that, that shaped how he looked at, how he approached the role of a father and making the family unit work, right? So it's every experience shapes our next experience, if that makes sense. Yeah. Right?
Is made meaning a thing? Is that a term?
Yeah.
Like, what's it mean?
We made meaning. I mean, I don't know.
You can't just
like,
repeat it.
A way to say that is that you don't live based on facts, but it's the interpretation of your situation facts that actually are what how you live.
So like the narration, the narrative around what you think those things meant.
Right. Right. It's not, you know, there's nothing about your reality is subjective. It's your interpretation of the reality that you live inside of.
And each thing influences the next. It's your narrative of shared experiences, single experiences. It's how you make meaning of things. And it never ends. Either, you know, it's not like, oh, I've come to my meaning. I've come to this.
Yeah.
No,
it's evolving.
Each one evolves to the next.
It's well documented how everybody always says how humans are engineered for story and narrative. We know that. And and the reason you could tell that is because that's what we do on a micro level. We make a story up about why this happened and it must be something. And so you're always going back to your previous experiences and trying to. It seems like it has meaning, whether it's coincidence or not. We make it into a narrative or a meaning. So the thing about my dad must have had something to do with this, and that's just the way that we interpret things. We put them into a story.
I see how I have been creating a narrative that's incorrect. So for a long time, I thought, like we talked about last time, my dad, like, oh, I think my dad doesn't need me. That's the thing I put in my own head. My dad never said he didn't need me.
Mm-hmm.
It's the lens and the meaning that I made of it. Mm-hmm.
When I was 6 years old, I didn't know, you know, I didn't know what was happening.
This is the story that I mentioned in the beginning of the episode. It's heavy and talks about domestic violence and sexual abuse, and we recommend that you do not listen to this story with young children present. If you feel the need to skip this story, that is totally okay. But we don't want you to miss out on the overarching message behind it and the reason we put it in this episode in the first place. This story is about a woman who was sexually abused by her father as a young child and also witnessed the domestic abuse of her mother by the same man. We chose this story because this moment in my friend's life, this experience when she was only 6 years old, has shaped her marriage to this very day.
I didn't know what was happening. I tried to tell my mom. I think she was so shocked by what I was even saying because I couldn't even articulate it. The first night it happened, I told her about it when she came home in my six-year-old words, you know, like, Daddy touched me with his whatever, or, you know, I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
I think she was, like, so shocked that she just kind of threw it out of her mind is how she described it later. But she also told me, like, I started drawing pictures of, like, naked men. I'm maybe 6 years old. I'm standing outside of the bathroom door. My mom's in the bathtub and my dad's got his hair blow dryer in there in a yelling fit. It's plugged into the wall and he throws it into the tub at her.
What happened?
It unplugged.
Oh my gosh.
Before it reached. But I mean, most of those things are on the little spirally, you know. Yeah. I could have watched my mom be electrocuted to death. Oh. And I saw him like throw things. They, like, you remember those little porcelain incense burning houses?
Mm-hmm.
He threw one of those at her. She had busted teeth because of him. Oh. It was bad. My parents got a divorce because my dad was having an affair with my stepmother. I don't know how long it would have lasted. If she hadn't come in the picture. I'm not saying that my mother was innocent of kind of pushing my dad's buttons, you know. She snapped at him, and I think they trained themselves after such a long time being together that they knew how to get on the other person's nerves, and there wasn't really a point where they stopped, you know. I think when I was 11 years old, I remember I was sitting in the car. My dad's driving. My stepmom is sitting in the passenger seat, and I'm sitting in the back seat with two siblings. We're driving home, and there's something on the radio, some news story about a man who sexually abused his daughter. I'm like sweating I'm looking in the rearview mirror at my dad's eyes the entire time, and just feeling like I have something that I'm hiding and I'm ashamed of that is being exposed. And as I'm watching his eyes, my stepmom is in the passenger seat freaking out about how terrible this man is, how she could never imagine a man would do something like that. Keep in mind, I'm also looking to my stepmom kind of as like a savior from this terribly abusive relationship that my dad had with my mother. So she kind of came into the picture, even though it was in a very sinful way. I looked to her as like this beacon of like morality and justice and good, you know, and this fear of my secret being exposed rattled me. Like I didn't know what to do with myself, because if she knew this, clearly she's gonna leave my father, mm-hmm. and then he's gonna turn back into this mm-hmm. wild animal who he was before. Mm-hmm. But I just remember so clearly, like watching his eyes in the rearview mirror, not even like flinch, not even a single flinch.
What did you guys do, or what have you been doing to work through the abuse issues and what that looks like in your marriage?
My husband asked me to go through some classes. I went through counseling twice with a couple of different people on sort of different related topics, but they all both explored it because it was a big part of my experience as a child. I feel like there probably is still a lot more action to be taken, honestly. I think a big step forward for both of us has been those instances where I've felt comfortable being vulnerable and opening up to a handful of close friends, or talking to my husband, just being honest in the moment, and being willing to not just be comfortable and complacent, but actually prodding into those things, even when it feels really uncomfortable or you don't want to talk about it. But it's difficult. Sometimes you're not the one who's uncomfortable, and the person who's uncomfortable is your spouse. And you can't force them to talk. You know, it's just going to push them further away and shut them down. So definitely being vulnerable and being honest and having somebody to talk to, even if it's not your spouse, is important. But as much as possible, those conversations need to start with your spouse.
That really sounds to me isolating, and gathering all the tape for this podcast and all the stories across all the episodes. What strikes me is that the main difference is in experiences that you have that are either isolating, that you deal with the death of a parent that your spouse does not, or something that happens to you at worst case scenario when you're a child and you can't even articulate the experience you're having, you have little to no chance of sharing it with anybody at all. And then on the other hand, you have experiences where parents together have a shared loss of a child or a child with disability. And the difference in what's shared and what's not and how well it's shared seems to be the really big difference. And I think that must be what, I mean, it kind of gave me this light bulb of clarity about, oh, that's what therapy is. That's what talking about stuff is. That's what telling other people's stories and letting them connect to it is. Experiencing things in isolation is terrible.
Oh, so that's interesting. So you're saying you're taking an isolated experience and you're creating it, you're turning it into, yes, a shared experience, right, by sitting down with someone and talking.
And that's what therapy is, and that's kind of what this podcast hopefully is achieving in some degree, because it makes me identify with the Susie from episode one, or know, these stories this way. And some it's so clear when you see a man and a woman share an experience together and move forward, that's binding, versus all the most terrible of stories is one where you hear it and it seems like somebody had something bad happen to them and in isolation or kept from other people and stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I want your opinions on this, because Seth and I talk about this a lot, and it's a so personal experience health wise on my part, because as a kid I had lots of weird health things happen, like
injuries.
So I got in a really bad car accident when I was 9 with mm-hmm. no seatbelts. My sister broke the windshield with her head. I mean, it was terrible. We were in like an old metal 70s car. And then the next year, I lost my spleen. I fell off my deck, and it ruptured into my body. And then from that traumatic accident, I now have spleens growing all over my internal organs and
splenoids,
uterus and stuff. And then I lost my appendix. I got sick last year and had my appendix removed. I had a miscarriage. So I have had all of these weird physical things. It just feels like I get them over and over and over again. And I feel like those are isolating and that Seth doesn't understand them.
Right.
I think you have to understand that those experiences aren't isolating. You're not isolated from talking to me about those. We've talked about them for years, right? So I think what you're looking for in that is maybe you want some sort of sympathy or empathy. Like, I don't have to, you know, fall off a deck and injure my spleen. Oh, great. Now our marriage is better because we understand one another. It's the level at which I like can connect with you and listen to you about those things, which I feel that I have, but you want me to feel more sorry for you on some level.
That's what I'm saying. I don't even know what I want from you, but I genuinely feel like you don't get how it, because there's something about being physically ill. Like when I had the miscarriage, a month after losing the baby, I got horribly sick. I had, they thought it was endometritis, which is different than endometriosis. I was hospitalized, and then they found the splenules and gave me the nuclear medicine test. They gave me the wrong nuclear medicine test. So they injected me with radioactive medicine, the wrong one.
Yeah, the wrong one.
So then the next day they injected me with another one. And there's some sort of trauma around that I feel like is, it's like it makes everything is harder to understand after you go through something like that. And there's something that feels urgent in me for you to understand it, but I don't know what it is.
I think the urgency is the longing for connection. I can never have that experience that you have, right? Or have had. I can't. Much like you can't have certain experiences that I have, you know. On some things, we cannot look through the other person's lens, right? What I can do is connect with you on that. I think what you're looking for, it's not about the injuries, it's not about the physical trauma. It's about the thing that you want is that feeling of connectedness, that feeling of like, okay, my spouse understands. He gets me. He's a soft place to land. He can listen, you know, etc. But I can't go through that trauma that you went through.
I guess I kind of just wanted to talk about it because I am definitely not alone in having physical illness things happen. And then I think particularly female reproductive stuff is really weird. It's extremely frustrating, and you can't voice it in a way that makes sense to people, and it's overwhelming and it's scary. It impacts our marriage,
right?
That I worry about if I'm gonna get sick again. You know, when we started this podcast, like 2 months in, I got my appendix infected and I had to have a surgery, and then the surgery was harder because I've had past surgeries when I had lost my spleen. So I'm like, I mean, my intestines were like adhered to my abdominal walls, just crazy crap,
right?
You know?
Well, right. The hard thing about that is, as we were speaking before about narrative and story, is you almost don't have the choice but to tell yourself that this is part of a story or part of who I am, or I'm a victim, or physical things happen to me. There's a confirmation bias there, and you continue to recognize it as, see, these things happen to me.
I know what it is. You yourself haven't made meaning of those things.
I can't.
But you're expecting other people to. And when you expect other people to figure out your story for you, it could be a conflictual place to live, you know, to be. And especially in relationship, like, I can't understand. I can't make meaning. I can't solve it for you, because that's you. It's your journey. It's your narrative. It's your choice to make meaning of that. So only when you make meaning is when you can share that meaning with me, and I'll be the soft place to land.
Wow, guys, what a heavy but hopefully meaningful for you episode. We all have stories that shape and influence who we are. And I know Alyssa and I are so thankful to all the people who have shared their stories in this week's episode, and to Melanie and Seth specifically for bringing these stories to us. So next week, Alyssa and I will be back talking about life and answering your questions. And thanks so much for listening. And if you haven't left us a review on iTunes or subscribed to the show, what are you waiting for? Seriously, though, it actually really, really goes a long way in regards to getting it in front of other people and keeping the podcast going. So if you like the show and you find it helpful, it'd be amazing if you just took 30 seconds out of your day and you let the world know by subscribing, rating the show, and then sending us a screen capture or something to Twitter at Jefferson Bethke. But yeah, we love you guys so much. Take care.